really ticks me off. Clem walks in, walks out. I've been waiting for 10 minutes to start a work session. Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection into session this morning, Tuesday, May 24th. And we're going to start out with a quick work session before we get into our informational public hearing. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 16A. Jan, can you give us a description of the bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 16A is the bill that allows the state treasurer to name a designee to serve in lieu of the treasurer on the college savings board, and it directs the treasurer to designate the board chairperson. It requires the board to report annually to the governor and the legislative assembly. There was an amendment that the committee adopted. It's the Dash A2 amendment that requires that the report be prepared by March 15th of each year. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 16 to the floor of a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 16A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Anyone wish to hear from the State Treasurer's Office? No, pretty cut and dry. I think we've had this discussion pretty much. And seeing no questions, we have a motion on the table. Tamara, can we have our vote, please?
Representative Cavan.
Excused.
Representative Clem.
Absent.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Excused.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Holt.
Aye. Senate Bill 16A, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. And carrier for the bill? Any volunteers?
I'll do it.
Representative Wisnett, thank you. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 16. And I'm going to open an informational public hearing on House Bill 3183. Jan, can you give us a description of House Bill 3183, please?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this bill allows a city, a county, or a county to establish rent controls on spaces in a facility for manufactured dwellings or floating homes. And there are no amendments before you.
All right. We are going to have... we have invited testimony for this bill, and I apologize for many of those who may have come and wanted to provide testimony on this bill. We will accept written testimony on it. And if the co-chair would agree, we'll keep the testimony open for today and through tomorrow at 5 o'clock. If you want to submit something by email to our committee administrator, we will put that on the record for this bill as well. And so we have invited testimony where we have six proponents and six opponents, and I'm going to bring them up in groups of three or close to it sometimes. And with that, we're going to start out with Representative Kotek. And good morning and welcome, and thank you for your patience.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holy, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Tina Kotek. I'm the state representative for House District 44, which is North and Northeast Portland. I'm here today. First of all, I want to thank you. I know you've had a very busy schedule, and scheduling an informational hearing is important for my constituents because this bill came from the residents of a manufactured home community on Hayden Island. Many of you probably know Hayden Island. It's the Janssen Beach area as you go into Vancouver. That's right in the middle of my district. And the group that asked me to bring this bill forward was the Hayden Island Livability Project. And so it's always important to make sure our constituents have a voice. So thank you for the opportunity today. My district has 9 manufactured home communities and several floating home mortgages with a combined total of over 1,000 spaces in my district. Most of the people who live in these communities own their home but rent the space on which it resides. In many cases, the buildings themselves are physically too old to be moved. Even if the homes are capable of surviving a move, the cost is prohibitive for many homeowners, ranging as high as $20,000 for a move. The permanency of the rental relationship can expose homeowners to exorbitant rent increases on the spaces their homes occupy. The 89,500 residents in Oregon's mobile home communities need the oversight of local governments to ensure that this vulnerability is not being exploited. The bill you have that we're hearing today, House Bill 3183, was a simple fix. It said, let's remove the prohibition on local rent control as applied to spaces in manufactured and floating home facilities. And that's how it's defined in the law, or in the bill. It's one way to protect at the local level the residents who live in these communities. And you're going to hear from my constituents today in this one particular park of the issues they've been dealing with. And sometimes local intervention wouldn't be appropriate. But what this bill would do is provide the option at the local level for the local jurisdiction to decide if they need to be involved. And I think that's, given the very narrow scope of this bill and the narrow scope of the residents we're dealing with, I think that's an appropriate proposal. The vulnerable position of manufactured home residents is even more problematic considering the kinds of individuals who often own these homes. As a group, manufactured home residents are disproportionately elderly, disabled, low-income, or from minority groups. They're often disenfranchised due to these characteristics, making them easy targets for exploitation and discrimination. Not all manufactured housing communities are organized and assertive, like the individuals testifying before you today. And I have to say, I applaud their courage and their desire to speak up on behalf of their fellow residents. Many do not have access to legal representation, nor are they aware of their rights and how to defend themselves. Their voices are rarely heard, but the echoes of the difficulties they face speak volumes about our society. In the testimony you'll hear today, manufactured homeowners will share their stories of the harshness of rent increases they've experienced, far exceeding any increase justified by changes in the economy. These stories are only examples. Just a snapshot from my district. Throughout our communities, the rents for spaces in some manufactured housing facilities have skyrocketed. There is no limitation on how frequently or by how much these rents can be increased, except that the homeowner must be notified 3 months in advance. In most cases, the homeowners have no choice but to pay the increased rent or abandon their homes, the assets that they live in. As legislators, we have the responsibility to ensure that the most vulnerable in our communities are protected. We need to address the current problems of rent increases in manufactured and floating home communities. And I thank you for beginning this conversation today, and I look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kotek. I do agree this is a discussion that's been in this building a couple of times before, and definitely a difficult issue that we, I do believe, deserves a discussion and seeing if there's some way to deal with these issues in a fair way. And that's the purpose of this public hearing, to sort of hear from both sides. And I appreciate you your advocacy for your constituents. I know these issues exist in other places in the state as well, but there are a lot of issues, as you know, around this. So any questions of Representative Kotek? See you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Kutcher, thank you, Colin.
So first up, I'd like to call up Herman Kacheld.
That's pretty good.
Which one?
Which one was Donna Murph and Donna Murphy?
Which one was a good one?
And Linda Caso.
Okay.
I've got some written. I'll submit over here.
Yes, and if you are submitting written testimony, don't get up and read it to us, because we do have the ability to read later on. But if you could summarize your testimony or give us your point of view on this issue, and that would be helpful for us. So if you would introduce yourself first for the record, whoever is going to go first.
My name's Herman Kacheld. I live in the Hayden Island Manufactured Home Community on Hayden Island in North Portland. Been there since about 2007. and the co-chair of the Hayden Island Livability Project, who's concerned about the island and other effects besides what we're dealing with the home community. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to present some testimony on why we feel this bill is important. Our own personal experience has been since September of 07 when we moved in, we've seen a rent increase of about 12% in a 3 or 4 year period, which is, when you look at the Social Security, cost of living hasn't increased the last 2 years. It may not this year, who knows. But it seems like our cost of living keeps going up. I mean, our taxes, property taxes, took a huge jump this past year. I was able to curb that a little bit. But this ability to go to our local jurisdictions to see if we can get some kind of control over the rent increases, it seems like the least evasive process there is. It leaves it up to our local communities to decide whether we have a legitimate claim to hold down those rents. And I don't think it's that severe of a measure, because personally I'm not a great big rent control advocate, but in our situation, since we don't control the land, property values go up, we get hurt because our property is not, we don't own it. We pay taxes on the property through our space rent. We pay also additional, we pay taxes on the unit itself. In our case, we've got an old 68 unit. It couldn't be moved. We're kind of stuck. We either walk away from it, or hopefully we can sell it. Fortunately, we're in a park that the possibility of sale is always there. But there's also a lot of units that haven't sold either. So you don't never know for sure if you can turn that unit over and move on to somewhere else in a timely manner. Might just have to walk away. You don't know. But this would at least give us some control to be able to stay. We moved to Hayden Island with the idea that this was going to be our last move. I'm going to retire in September. My wife is already retired. That was going to be our place to retire to and stay there. And hopefully the rents won't go so high and the taxes won't go so high. We won't be able to do that. We'll be able to stay there on the island. Because it's like being on a vacation almost all the time. Because you're out on the river. It's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. And I appreciate that. And if I failed to mention, we're trying to hold people to 3 minutes for their testimony, and you did quite well on that. But just for the record, if you can keep your testimony at 3 minutes, and we'll let you know. So if you'd introduce yourself first for the record.
Hi, I'm Linda Casso. I've lived on in the park for 3 years. I moved here 3 years ago, and basically because I needed affordable housing, and as I near retirement age, you know, trying to decide when am I going to start taking my Social Security, this is becoming, you know, just an enormous issue for me and many of my peers. And since I've been living in the park, it's been interesting to see how many people have asked me about how it works there and what's going on. And because, you know, people my age and people I think in everywhere are scrambling for affordable situations. The economic situation in this country is, you know, unsettling to say the least. And, you know, I'm someone who has worked all my life. I have over 40 years worth of experience. I've had, you know, high profile jobs, and now in Oregon it's been a lot more difficult because, you know, I'm basically an overeducated, you know, workhorse type person who's, you know, working really underemployed here, just barely making poverty level wages. I work as a companion for an elderly person. So for me, affordable housing is just an enormous issue. And you know, the park we live in is located, you know, it's an island and it's by the river, and it's an old park, so it's been maintained and the parts of it are quite lovely. And, you know, I really think the management has done a lot to preserve a good quality of life there to some extent. I happen to live on a street that's 50-50. You know, there are some really old rundown trailers on my street, and then there are some newer, I live in one of the newer ones, a 10-year-old place, but none of these places will be moved. None of us have much recourse. And I keep, since I've been involved with the community for the last 3 years, I keep hearing stories of people whose renting increases seem to be really uneven. You know, there's a lot of, it's kind of how do you figure it out, you know? How do you figure out who's getting what? My increases have been fairly low, I think, compared to what I hear from other people. And I sort of, you know, weigh that for that piece of paper every time it comes around to see how much it's going to go up the next time. You know, I don't really know how it's being figured. So for somebody like me who's juggling a very little amount of money to live on and very little savings, it's an affordable housing is just an enormous issue, and that's why I'm there. So I would like to see a situation where we can kind of work with the park management and owners, but, you know, really, they're nice people, but I think that really, if the bridge project goes through and property values increase on the island, which, you know, we all can see it's going forward really quickly, the property values are going to increase, but our stake in it, and we're 440 units, about 1,400 people, you know, our stake in this investment that we're making, paying these taxes every year, is not going to come back to us, you know? So we're looking for some help for some kind of equitable situation, you know.
Thank you. Your time has expired. Am I talking too much?
Okay.
I think you summarized it very well. So thank you for that. And if you
thanks for the chance.
If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Okay. Hi, my name is Donna Murphy. I live on Hayden Island also. I'm a co-chair for HILP also with Herman Kaysheld. The reason we're here is to ask for some help and protection. We own our home free and clear. We've lived on this island for 2 years this June. And because of health issues, we've needed to downsize. We've had many homes, many large homes, and we just couldn't do it anymore. So we downsized. We love living on the river's edge. It's exciting, and it's one of the better places we've lived. We have a community. We're involved. We're a happy group, you know, and we're trying to get more people to join us. But we live on leased land. We have no rights under the current Oregon law. We pay the rent increases or we lose everything. This is our situation. Others throughout the state have 100% increases. Many people have been forced to abandon and take huge losses just to survive their once affordable housing. We are worried this could happen to us. Please help us to stay in our home. What we need is to allow local government to control rent rates and increases for manufactured dwellings and floating homes in order to protect these important and affordable types of housing. Please support HB 3183 by Representative Tina Kotek from District 44 in this legislative session. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Very brief, Mr. Chair. So in looking over some of the numbers here, it looks like your rent went up about 4% per year, but your taxes went up about 100%.
Oh, yeah.
200%.
200%. Yeah. So why not go out, and it looks like Multnomah County is the bad guy here. I mean, why not go out?
I feel the tax increase and was granted a reduction, so the taxes dropped down a little bit. It was about a 300% increase, that was dropped to about a 200% increase, so...
But why not have a meeting like this about that issue, about the increase in taxes?
I mean, that may be an issue to come up, yeah.
That's a huge issue. I mean, a lot of our places are totally overestimated, you know. It's not...
Yeah, some of the older homes have like a $5 or $8 a year tax because they have no value.
Right.
You know, they're old single-wide units that have no value. Our place happens to be on the river. So it has a little bit more value, possibly, because of that location. Although, in reality, if we could take that house and move it anywhere, the house is still the same value. It just happens to be because it's on the river, it's much nicer. You know, but we pay tax for the space rent, too.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Just to be clear, the taxes went up on your manufactured housing house, your structure.
I don't know if they went up on the track who owns the park, whether it went up on their tax bill or not. I would.
Whether the land went up.
Yeah, I don't know.
As well. Okay, any other questions? Seeing any, thank you for coming forward and participating in this hearing. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Next up, I'd like Chuck Carpenter. Gary Griglack and Mike Wells. Good morning, and if you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Great. Good morning. Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Carpenter. I'm executive director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We represent about 500 manufactured home communities here in the state of Oregon. I'd like to start off very briefly by thanking the committee for their support of Senate Bill 294, that is the Landlord-Tenant Coalition Bill, which hopefully we'll be passing out of this committee later this week. I think it's a great example of when residents and landlords can work together. We prefer to try to do it in that venue to resolve our issues, to come up with creative, common sense solutions to the problems that this industry faces. However, the bill that's before you today, House Bill 3183, is not a bill that we're likely to reach agreement on. House Bill, MHC opposes House Bill 3183 and the elimination of local preemption of rent control. This preemption was a result of House Bill 2505 from the 1985 legislative session. The legislature then realized that rent control, and particularly local rent control, was catastrophic to the supply of affordable housing in Oregon. Other states, Colorado, Wisconsin, Nevada, Maine, and Arizona, have similar preemptions. The precedent for local preemption is well established in Oregon. Oregon has preempted local control of land use, collective bargaining rights of employees is statewide, and Oregon has prohibited local governments from adopting local building codes. Owners of manufactured home communities are the single largest private provider of affordable housing in the state of Oregon. Rent control, whether imposed at the local level or state level, sends a chilling message to those owners and to the housing industry in general. It is a signal to these owners of manufactured home communities that government is better able to determine how an investment should be managed and what the returns on an investment should be rather than the owners of the community. Rent control may start as a simple ordinance with a catchy phrase: rent stabilization, rent justification, rent arbitration, but it quickly becomes an administrative nightmare with boards and inspectors, and yes, subsequent lawsuits. The inevitable result of this type of legislation will be to hurt the very people it is designed to help. It will cause community owners to seriously consider changing current communities to other commercial, industrial, or housing alternatives. Since manufactured home communities have been a form of non-subsidized housing that has been an affordable choice for some of the lowest income households in Oregon, the impact on these households will be very detrimental if capital is directed to other investment choices. The solution of rent control, whether locally or statewide, has the ultimate effect of harming the very households that proponents are trying to assist. For these reasons, MHCO is opposed to House Bill 3183. I thank the committee for taking the time to listen to our concerns, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We could bring up whoever wants to go next.
Hello, my name is Gary Griglack. I am the general manager of Hayden Island Manufactured Home Community. The company that I work for owns and operates 40 premier communities located in 9 states throughout the country and Canada. I've got over 30 years of manufactured housing experience, and I've worked for the same company during that duration. As you've heard from some of the residents that live in our community, we've got a gorgeous community located on the beautiful, majestic Columbia River. It is the most unique community that our company owns and the most valuable piece of real estate. Obviously, the Columbia River provides breathtaking, spectacular views for the people that live along the river. Our residents are referred to as islanders. Some of the amenities that our community offers is a 24-hour fitness center, two clubhouses that are totally free of charge to our residents, four heated swimming pools, laundry facilities, a scenic nature trail along the Columbia River, hair salon, barbershop, and shopping that's within, plentiful shopping within walking distance. Some of our home sites also include free lawn care, underground irrigation system, and the maintenance of that system. Historically, rents have been determined by market rent, which is consistent with the rents that are charged for various types of housing in the Portland area. It should be noted that we have made the decision to not raise rent this year for Hayden Island. The past 2 years of rent increases have been in the 2-3% range. Our rents are competitive and reasonable for the types of services and amenities that our community provides. As a result of all of this, Hayden Island enjoys a 99% occupancy level today. In addition, we only have 4% of our homes currently for sale, which indicates that we're doing a lot of things right. If people have to sell their home or need to sell their home, they have the ability to do so because of the community in which they live in. This is an absolute gorgeous community, and because of the way that it's maintained and improved upon, the value of the resident's home is improved because of this. When we acquired Hayden Island 18 years ago, our residents' biggest fear was that we would change the land use to a more profitable endeavor. That didn't happen. 18 years later, we are better than ever.
If you could wrap up with your conclusion, that would be great.
Okay. I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share my insights regarding this. I also want to let you know that I will contact the residents and hopefully try to set up a meeting with them to address their concerns. And I urge you to vote no for House Bill 3183. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, and thank you for having us here to talk to you on this rent control bill. I represent one of the small parks. I built and still own 50% of Cedar Glen Estates in Walters, Oregon.
If you could state your name for the record.
I'm Mike Wells. I'm sorry, sir. I built two other communities, both manufactured home communities, that converted to planned unit developments. Our residents are 80-90% seniors. They're not at the poverty level. We have a great relationship with our HOA, and we work together on solving a number of community problems, primary of which is local government. I'm active and at Clackamas County because they are the most significant increase. Our taxes last year increased 28% as a new school bond issue came through. Our sewer rates have gone up almost 20% over the last 5 years. We have kept our rental rates tied to the consumer price index for 17 years now since we built the community. We intend to continue to do this. Our residents are not at the poverty line, other than perhaps three of them. We have a help committee in the community that helps support people through the hard times of an accident or unemployment. I want to emphasize that the affordable housing base of this entire state is our communities. We are providing a very needed item, and in comparison to what we do pay taxes on, pay sewer rates on. Clackamas County is now embarking on some, the Housing Authority of Clackamas County is embarking on construction to build some 200 units at a cost of $221,000 per 1,000 square foot unit. When you think about whether public can do it better than private, I hope you'll think of that comparison. And by the way, the Housing Authority of Clackamas County doesn't pay school tax. So I thank you very much for listening to us, though, and keep in mind that there's a vast group of small communities like mine that provide a very enjoyable level of living for their residents. And thanks again.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Yeah.
Representative Smith.
Thanks for sure.
Chuck, what do we know about, I only know what one internet search told me, I don't know whether to trust it. What do we know about increases in rents on manufactured home parks compared to increases in rents generally in Oregon or in similar, you know, geographic areas within Oregon?
Co-chairs, Representative Smith, I have a database of rent, of what it's been over the last 5 years for about probably 150 properties across the state. It's very hard to quantify for manufactured housing because it's so diverse. You have high-end communities such as Songbrook and Eugene, and then you have other communities that are more geared towards affordable housing. So it's hard to measure it. But generally, in some cases, Representative, we're seeing at this point no rent increases or very, very minimal. I think when you compare it to the metropolitan area and some other areas, it's probably less than what you're seeing in some other types of housing. We always look at this as that somebody's going to pay X amount for the space, whether it's in Gary's community on the Columbia River or someplace else. So if the house is part of that equation, then they're only going to be willing to pay so much for the rent before they move. And we see that there's competitive factors in this. I mean, it's not just a question of other parks community competing with other communities. I mean, there are other housing alternatives that eventually, if we price ourselves out of the business, people move to apartments or other types of housing. So generally, I think the rents are reflective, if not less, than what you see in apartments and other types of housing.
Paul, sure. Do we, and this is not your association, so you're not held to happen to know this data, but do we know what, so if they received ballpark 12% increase over a three-year period, do we know, and that's not, I'm sure, necessarily the same as what's happening in manufactured home parks elsewhere in the state, but in this, on Hayden Island, do we know what percentage, roughly speaking, over that three-year period, Metropolitan Portland received in rent increases generally?
I can easily find that information out for you, Representative.
That'd be valuable.
To share that with you.
That'd be valuable. Another question, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Wanted to also ask, and I apologize, I forget your name, sir.
Gary.
Yes. And you're Hayden Island, yeah?
Yes.
So part of what I hear is the motivation is that for the bill is that over the last 3 years there have been significant rent increases and, you know, $190 a year property tax increase. And some of what I heard was a fear of even a steeper increase going forward. What are the plans, you know, what are the plans over the next, you know, 5-10 years on Hayden Island as plans change with development, road building, et cetera?
Well, you know, market rents are, it's driven, rent increases and market level rents are driven by market. So it's like Chuck was indicating, it's not just competitive manufactured housing communities, but it's also the housing in the immediate area. You know, we have the unique distinction of being on the Columbia River, and all that has to offer. It's a premier, gorgeous community with million-dollar views. So it's the exception to the rule. It's exception to the affordable housing issue. You know, affordable housing is a function of location. So we're at the higher end of that level. We've got one of the nicest communities in the state and possibly in the country. It's the most unique piece of real estate that I'm familiar with. And I've been doing this for 30 years. So, you know, long term, I don't have an immediate answer, but, you know, decisions on rent increases are made on an annual basis. This year, we've made the decision not to raise the rent. The year prior to, the rent increase was a 2 to 3% rent increase. The year prior to that, it was a 2 to 3% rent increase. That's the way it was. So, you know, I heard the residents talk, and they didn't have any complaints about anything else but the rent. And yes, prior to that, the rent increases were more, but it was getting us, it was bringing us up to the market level. So, you know, we're at market. We've leveled off the rent increases. We've made the decision not to give a rent increase this year, and we'll have to reevaluate the future when that happens.
So, anticipatedly, if you got a big, if you get a new freeway interchange, our anticipation is that rent value, the market value of property on Hayden Island, will significantly increase, and you guys will, you know, do what the market will charge, what the market will bear.
Yeah, but we've got to be competitive. I mean, we're in business, so yeah. I mean, we have to be competitive. If we're not competitive, that's going to reflect in our occupancy, in the number of homes for sale. I mean, industry average for homes for sale in our industry is 10%.
Yeah.
And we've got 4%. So we've got less than half of the homes in our community for sale currently. That indicates a lot of good things. That means people are able to sell their homes. And we've got a sister sales company that helps people sell their homes if they need to or want to. So those are, I mean, we cannot price ourselves out of the market to be competitive. If we do that, we're going to develop vacancies, and then that obviously hurts us, hurts the people that I work for, and it obviously hurts the value of the homeowners.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good. A couple of questions. I know we got a lot of people here, so I'll try and keep it brief. Chuck, I think first probably. What is roughly the ratio of people who own the homes and the parts versus rent from somebody else who owns both the home? I mean, I know the underlying ground is generally owned by the owner, and then the part, the unit's owned by the person. But some people just rent too, don't they?
No, not in our community.
But I mean, statewide, nobody rents.
Statewide.
Yeah, that's why I was asking him. Sorry.
Co-chairs, Representative Clem, generally in manufactured home communities, we have always not encouraged, but I think that the attitude of community owners is that the rules and regulations of committee will say that there's no subleasing allowed. It just is made, it makes it for a very complicated situation where you have somebody who is what we refer to as subletting the home from somebody who owns the home that is renting the land. It becomes very complicated. We've been through the coalition in the last couple of years, Lieutenant Coalition, we've tried to clarify that to make it easier to clarify the rights and responsibilities of the three parties involved, the person who owns the space, the person who owns the home, and the person who's renting the home. And we've, I think, come up with some reasonable solutions to that, but it's still very complicated. I would say that probably 90% of the communities in the state of Oregon do not allow subletting.
Okay. So, follow up, Mr. Chair.
So,
you know, the thing that troubles me a little bit about some of the testimony is the ease of which we talk about these people's ability to move. Like, yeah, they can always go somewhere else. Well, it's not, you really can't just shell out $30,000, you know, when you're a limited budget anyway, and move. I mean, it really is not that easy. I have 17 parks in my area, and most of them are great. Everything's working out, but there's been one that was converted to a subdivision. A lot of people did need to move, and they sat on homes for sale while having to go get other places, and they had two mortgages going, and, I mean, really put people in a hard spot because the tax credit and other programs, even the owner payments in a closure, it's not even close to what the rate of the cost to move something is. And then, you know, that assumes there's availability. A lot of people, you know, had problems finding anywhere to move to, even if they could move. And so it's not, you know, I'm not disputing some of the arguments the owners have made, but the sort of, you know, light nature that we talk about, well, people can always go somewhere else. Well, it's not really that easy. I mean, it really isn't. And I've heard that over and over from my constituents about the ability. And so that's why I think, you know, I think my question is, you know, you've made a plausible case to me that your rent increases are justified. So the question is, if there was a rent justification procedure, are you really that nervous you wouldn't be able to make your case there and have it approved? You know, because of the unique nature of the inability to just move on a 30-day, you know, month-to-month kind of lease the way someone in an apartment could, for example.
Representative Co-Chair, if I may comment, just to sort of share with you the other side of that equation. These are difficult issues, and we all acknowledge that. But no one is, I don't know of a community owner that is interested in raising the rent so high that people are forced out of the community. What a lot of people don't understand is that on the other side of this equation is the landlord, the community owner, who, if they make the rent so implausible for people, so unaffordable for people to live in, then that house is going to become vacant. And what happens to that house? Well, then they have to go through abandonment, which costs a significant amount of money. And if that home never rents again, or that space never rents again because the rents are too high, then the landlord, the community owner, is faced with disposing of that home, which can be $10,000-$15,000. And that's a lot of rent to have to recoup. So the incentive here is to keep these things reasonable, because for a lot of folks, this land is the best use for this piece of property in many cases. And there is not the incentive to raise the rate to the point where people are forced out and no one is interested in buying the home. So folks like the two gentlemen that are next to me here are faced with spending $5,000 on legal fees or whatever, or $15,000 to dispose of a home, and then the inability to find a home to put in there because they're not being manufactured anymore. So there's a lot of sort of hidden things here, and we really don't talk about the other side of it. Is what's the cost to a landlord or a community owner if they lose somebody? It is very, very expensive, and there is no recoup. There's no way to recover $15,000. I mean, the resident has abandoned the property. They have maybe unhappily moved to an apartment, but the landlord is just as unhappy because they're sitting there with a huge expense trying to dispose of a home. And in some of these cases, these homes that may have asbestos, it becomes very, very expensive to dispose of them. So this is there's no simple solution to this. We try to do the best we can. There's 60 pages of Chapter 90 that covers the rights and responsibilities of both parties, and we have the landlord and a coalition to work these issues through, but they're not simple solutions.
And just one quick follow-up, and I wouldn't assert they are. My point was just that the ease of moving is not like when I was in my 20s and I was like, I hate this landlord. I'm mad about my rent increase. I'm going to get another apartment. You know, it's not quite that way.
If I could, just a quick comment for Representative Clem is one of the general problems in the housing industry right now. We have several people wanting to move into our community that cannot get their major big house in the metro area sold. We have always had somewhat of a waiting list wanting to move in, waiting for the right one to come available. But the larger housing market has so frozen up that these, as they come to become seniors, they don't have the opportunity, so that hurts my sellers. So hope you'll expand the thought to the larger housing base, not just to manufactured home communities. Thank you.
And just one final little brief comment. The other thing, too, is the ease in which a resident can sell his or her home is much greater in a better maintained, nicer community.
True.
So that's really important to note.
So, and the questions have gone along with this panel a little bit, but I do have one other question for you, Chuck. I know that we've had a lot of discussions about trying to protect manufactured housing facilities as a stock of affordable housing, and there's been some pressures as values go up to convert them to other uses and those sorts of things. I'm just curious about if a rent control legislation was in and you have a manufactured housing park that had an owner who wanted out, and he wants to sell it, how does this kind of legislation, how does that play into the potential of actually selling and financing a new owner of a park?
Representative Holby, co-chair members, I think that in a rent control environment, once the housing market rebounds. And we were back in face with the situation that we were faced with in the go-go years in 2005, when communities were closing and being converted to subdivisions. I think that will accelerate in the next boom cycle as owners are faced with the fact that they may be very limited in raising their rents, where at the same time their sewer is going up, their taxes are going up. These communities are aging, which is something that we all need to take into account, that a lot of these communities were built in the 60s and 70s, and they are going to be in need of repair, and how that's going to have to be reflected in rent increases. And so if you're going to limit the ability of these community owners to raise rents, to be able to cover those expenses, nothing's for free. And these communities, I think you will see in the next cycle, as housing rebounds, that you'll see an accelerated move in selling these communities, because they're in many cases in prime locations. And if you're going to limit the ability, then that's going to be a problem. And I think the other issue, Representative, is that if you impose rent control, then you're going to force people to have rent increases every year, because they're never going to be able to go back and retroactively go back. And if they don't do a rent increase for 3 years, they can't go back and recoup that. So you're locking people into whatever that maximum rent is going to be, just in case that down the road that resident, the community owner, needs to replace the roads, replace the sewer. I mean, the next crisis that we may very well face in manufactured housing is, as these communities age and they need new sewers and new roads and all the new infrastructure, who's going to pay for that?
All right. Appreciate your testimony and answering the questions. So next up, I'm going to call up Pam Ferguson and Debbie Heckhausen.
Yep, good job.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You would start out by introducing yourself first.
Sure. My name is Pam Ferguson. I live on Hayden Island in Portland, Oregon. I have lived there for about 8 years now. So my mother, who was recently deceased at about age 76, and I looked all over the area at all the manufactured home communities before we settled on Hayden Island. It was convenient to downtown shopping, restaurants, services, had lovely large vegetation and a beautiful river view. She loved it there. It was her dream, and the dream of many people in that generation, to live in a new manufactured home. Both her parents and grandparents had lived in manufactured homes in Florida, and it was now her turn. I'm also the president of the Homeowners Association for the Hayden Island Manufactured Home Community. I've been in that position for about 5 years. The people at this hearing today are just the starting lineup for our community. We are not the whole team. We are just here representing as many people as we could. We're here representing many other people that could not appear today due to health reasons, work, or they just couldn't get up that early. Our community is made up of many different demographics. Seniors represent about 60% of the people that live in the community. They're single-parent families, multi-generational families, single people, many people of color, multilingual groups, but mostly people on a fixed income. Many of our residents have lived in this community for 20, 25, 30, or 35 years. The city of Portland produced a study a few years back that showed that Oregonians living in manufactured home communities were generally very good citizens. They had pride of their home ownership, pride of community, and a work ethic above people that pay rent only for their housing. Manufactured home communities provide affordable homes, usually affordable site rents, and a sense of community that is unmatched in any other housing type. The people that live in the Hayden Island manufactured home community are proud homeowners. They do not want to rent a home, apartment, or condo. They want to own a small home, plant flowers, and pay a bit of personal property tax. Residents here want to know their neighbors and play bingo, bunco, and Mexican train dominoes until way past the sun time the sun goes down. Manufactured home community residents are caught in a trap. We live in a mobile manufactured home park, but how mobile is it really? Most homes built before 1976 cannot be moved. Newer homes cost $10,000 plus to move, and only if you can find a space in another community that will accept your home. A study showed that statewide, less than 3% of these homeowners ever move their mobile homes. So we are stuck. We are held hostage by park management when they want to increase our site rents. This legislation is important to begin the conversation about protecting existing residents in manufactured home communities from rent increases that would force residents out because they could not afford to stay. If there was not strict rent control, I would like to see certain municipalities be able to create a grandfather clause, perhaps, to protect residents who have lived in a community a certain number of years. Let's get creative. Yes, there are horror stories in every community about Social Security holding steady, and rents going up, and seniors not being able to afford food over medicine. It's all part of the difficult economic landscape. It's a shame that there's no new manufactured home communities being built, marketed, or planned for. I understand that land values and property taxes are prohibitive, but this type of housing should be given special consideration, especially knowing that Oregon's aging population will be attracted to this downsized and easier lifestyle in the near future.
If you could conclude... Thank you.
At a financial investment seminar I recently attended, the concept of investing in the purchase of a manufactured home community was brought up twice as an excellent financial investment. I also recommend that you Google YouTube Jeanette Borland, B-O-R-L-U-N-D. She and her twin sister Jeanette have lived in our community for about 32 years now. And this is a story about how they've had 32 years of rent increases.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
All right. I'm Deborah Heckhausen, and I live on Hayden Island in the mobile home community. Representative Clem, you had a great point about if the parks are being responsible with raises, what have they to fear over having some limitations. I am disabled. I am on Social Security. I have a chronic illness that is not a good one to have. You have to have one. Living on a fixed income is very difficult. Affordable housing, I never thought I would see myself in this position at this particular age. I was looking forward to retirement, have a terrible accident, and things went downhill from there. Affordable housing is a very important issue to me. And yes, I do weigh out which medication I will skip this month and which food I will buy this month. I'm not quite sure what mobile home park the man that was sitting in this chair is part of, but just for the record, we do pay for lawn care. That is not free. It's included in our space rent. We pay more space rent. The rec center is not open 24 hours a day, and Premier is a stretch. It's a nice place. The real estate obviously is worth something, but many, many people in our community live in poverty, and I'm one of them. I live well below the federal poverty line. And that's, like I said, I don't know what park he's in, but I know all winter I've looked at mattresses and bed frames, and there is garbage and open bottoms to the mobile homes around me. There are many homes that people walk away from. There's almost like a separate business going on of repos in the park. I'm not saying they make money off of them, but people are being, you know, are walking away from their places. It's difficult. People in a park have a difficult time financially. So affordable housing is a very important issue. Incremental rent increases is a good idea. The seemingly arbitrary rent increases are not. Anyway, that's about all I have to say. It's an important issue, and there are many of us baby boomers that are in a more difficult position.
Thank you. Thank you, Deborah and Pam. Committee members, questions? Thank you very much for coming and providing us your testimony. Next, we have Mr. Delaney, Kim Berry, and Larry Engelgall. Good morning. We still have two other hearings today, so please introduce yourself. Don't forget. Provide us your concise testimony.
Good morning, representatives and members of the committee.
My name is Richard Delaney. I'm in the mobile home park business. I represent parks in five western states and have somewhat of a unique perspective in this case. 19 of these parks are in Oregon. In my 30 years in the business, I've never seen an instance where rent control works. It has reduced the housing stock everywhere it's been tried, and I've seen a lot of unintended effects. I've listed 10 of them in a letter that I sent to you. I won't go through them all, but I have personal experience in Santa Rosa, for example, where the same mobile home that sold for $15,000 before rent control went in was selling today for over $100,000. It, in effect, has reduced the affordable housing stock in Santa Rosa. I've seen in Yucaipa, which used to be a beautiful town with a lot, maybe 20-25% of the population living in mobile homes. The mobile home stock has gone to a point where the city itself admits that almost half of the mobile home parks are marginal, and the city has been forced to take over one. I believe that local option is a very poor choice, and I'll skip through some of the points, but the times that I've seen a group of tenants or anybody coming to a committee, oftentimes the committee makes a quick choice just to put the problem aside or to pass it down the road. And it's sort of an example of the squeaky wheel getting the argument. Look, for example, at some of the numbers. In our particular case, it's about 20% of the mobile homes in our parks that turn every year. That's a lot of parks, and that's a lot of turnover. The idea is that you're locked in. Well, 20% of these people aren't locked in. Another example, and it's just random, but I was sitting there, of the five people who spoke advocating the law, it looks to me like three of them have just been there for a short period of time. So they just recently bought in. They're not locked in. They bought in. The other points I would make are two. Rent control creates an empowered group. And it does that by taking privileges or rights away from one group and transferring it to the other. So the landlord, in this case, loses privileges and rights, and he's forced to defend himself, whether he cuts back on maintenance or whether he goes to the courts and litigates the issue. He sees that he's losing rights. And the empowered group, who are the people in the mobile homes, have rights that are better than anybody else in the state of Oregon. So if you look at the big numbers, say there's 90,000 people living in mobile home parks in Oregon, and there's 3.5 million people living in Oregon, those 90,000 people are better off than the rest of the 3.5 million people because they've been given special rights. I don't see a moral or legal justification for rent control. I think everyone wants to help those in need, and I honestly think the people I work for do that to the best of their ability. But where is it determined?
Go ahead and conclude. I appreciate it.
Where is it determined that the landlord is the one who's going to subsidize the people who need help?
If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
I'm Kim Berry. I'm the owner of a mobile home park and a broker specializing in the sale of mobile home parks. And I'm an advocate for low-income housing. There are approximately 1,250 mobile home parks with 66,000, probably more, spaces in Oregon. The vast majority of these parks were built in the 1950s and 60s and are in dire need of capital improvements. Some of the rents are very low by any standard, $250 a month, including sewer, water, and garbage, $300 a month in major metropolitan areas, and this isn't uncommon. At the same time, the 40 to 60-year-old sewer and water lines are falling apart, the paving is falling apart, deteriorating, and the homes are abandoned, some of them, and actually falling apart. Renovating a mobile home park takes a tremendous amount of money, time, and knowledge. And the only people who are willing and able to preserve these old parks are investors. There are 1,200 of them in the state of Oregon. If rent control is imposed, the majority of these older parks would continue to deteriorate. There's no doubt about that. Empty out and eventually close. Currently, I know of at least 5 situations where the owners of large parks are deciding on whether they should let the park empty out through attrition, which is already happening, and sell the land, or should they put a tremendous amount of money and work back into the park so that they can preserve it. If rent control was in place, they would without a doubt let the park empty out. Here are some of the stories that you've not heard about mobile home park owners helping low-income tenants. It's more common than not that if a tenant has a hardship, that the mobile home park owner will work with them to pay as much as possible and then eventually catch up rather than evicting them. That is commonplace. Every park has that situation. That doesn't happen elsewhere. In one large park that I was involved with, there were 4 tenants who had not paid rent for 2 years. One had cancer, one was very old with no family members, and one, a couple, husband and wife, had AIDS. They had not paid for 2 years. Additionally, there were many who were 6-plus months behind in rent, and the rent was $45 lower than any other park around and hundreds of dollars lower than any apartment by a long shot. The owners of the park did not have the heart to change the rent or to charge these people. Although the park was about to be foreclosed for taxes, they didn't get the income enough to pay taxes and maintain the park. The park sold 2 months prior to this happening. The new owners have since renovated 21 of these empty abandoned homes and sold them to low-income families. They're very happy. Last time I went back there, it was clean and a beautiful place to live. They've replaced broken and collapsed sewer lines, replaced water pipes. The roads are cleaned up, and it's a wonderful place to live. Over $100,000 has been put into these improvements. Yes, the rents did go up in the park, but they're still very, very low compared to any other living situation that they could have. And the place is very clean and a good, safe, affordable place to live for low-income housing. None of this would have happened if rent control was in place. 3 years ago, the park that I bought was half empty and was ready to be sold to the adjacent property owner, who's an industrial operation. They want to expand their operation. Instead, I bought the park. Now there are 22 homes. It is full, it is safe, and it's affordable, incredibly affordable, way lower than any other apartment or any other living in that area. Rent control would certainly eliminate a tremendous amount of good quality, low-income housing for hundreds, if not thousands, of deserving, hardworking individuals, families, and seniors. It would have the complete opposite effect of what you are trying to accomplish. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Larry Engelgaun. I'd like to begin by maybe, if it's okay, just responding to Representative Clem's question, because I think there are some misconceptions about how one moves in or out of a park. And because I've heard this several times, not just here, but other places, that it's almost insurmountable to pick up your home or take your home with you because of the cost and to move out of a park. And to a certain degree, that's true. But that's really not the way it takes place. Typically, the owner puts his home up for sale and it's sold on site. The amount? Yeah, okay. And I would say that's probably true in 95% of the cases. And they use a realtor to do it just like one would use in selling a stick-built home. And I have a park in Oregon City, and we have a waiting list of people waiting to buy homes in that park. So, and the manager maintains, so we don't use a realtor there. but manager maintains that list, and as it becomes available, he goes back and contacts people. So I think it's a lot. It's not always easy, and a lot of it depends, I think, on the park itself, how well it's maintained, the amenities in that park, and how well the homes within that park are maintained. And they're all actually kind of correlate, I think. Well-maintained park, you get, you know, the homes are better maintained. So I don't know if that clears it up at all, or maybe not.
I'll respond real quick.
He needs to finish his testimony, please.
Okay, all right. But anyway, it brought me back to the park that I was talking about in Oregon City by the name of Maple Lane. And I was there about a week ago. I walked the park, and I met with a new resident in the park. She had previously lived in an apartment in Astoria. And she had paid, I think she said, $750 a month for the apartment in Astoria. And she had about 700 and some square feet. She was telling me how much she liked our park, that is Maple Lane. And I would invite the members of this committee to walk the park that I'm talking about, to speak to the residents in the park and verify what I'm saying. Because I don't think you'll find a higher, morale in any neighborhood in the greater Portland area. But the thing she liked about it was she said she felt safer. She was a senior, and the apartment house she lived in was quite noisy. She had people on both sides and above her. And she said she was afraid to go out at night. Now, I understand some seniors are a little paranoid about people that are younger or what's going to happen if they go outside. But she said she could now, and she walks her dog and takes them out. She knows the people. They have bingo and they have bunko games, and they have potluck. She's got to know the people within the community. So there's more of a sense of community or neighborhood within this park than there was in the apartment house she lived in Astoria. So anyway, I think it's a lifestyle that, at least for some people, is superior to living in an apartment house or living in an apartment. The other thing about it is,
if you could go ahead and conclude, please.
Okay, real quickly, they're not commodities, and I think that is, mobile home parks are not commodities, and I think that a rent control would treat them as though they're commodities. They have different amenities. They have ownership. That some invest more, some invest less in the park itself, in the maintenance of the park, and in improving the park. So, anyway.
Thank you, and we're running quite a bit over our time for other bills. I do appreciate all the testimony and trying to just brief us specifically about rent control and how it affects the community as well. Certainly we have some issues about affordable housing and the fairness of people being able to stay in their homes is clearly a statewide issue. And how we go about accomplishing that is what our debate is about always. And I appreciate that people, have difference of opinion on both sides. And I, again, appreciate the testimony, and I'm sure this conversation will continue. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3183. You can ask him after the session if he's available, because I really do need to move on with the next panel on a new topic. Thank you. With that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3531. Jan, can you give us a quick description of House Bill 3531?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this bill repeals provisions that prohibit a local government from adopting land use regulations or imposing conditions on the approval of permits that effectively establish sales prices for houses or lots.
Excuse me. Excuse me, if you could take your conversations out so we can continue our business, I would appreciate it.
It's really expensive.
I have to. Yeah. Less than that.
Okay.
So with that, let's reconvene.
I'm not going to stick around.
Jan.
With the rest of bills.
Got some other bills.
They're pretty interesting.
Yeah.
This is a crowd, Mr. Chair. We should have done them at last. We have an audience full time.
But the state treasurer needs someone in lieu of them. If you could continue, Jan, please.
This is repeals provisions that prohibits local governments from adopting regulations or imposing conditions on permits that effectively establish sale prices for houses or lots. And there are no amendments before you.
Thank you. We have quite a few people signed up, and I'm going to have to apologize. We're going to cut your time down to 2 minutes per person. And first up, I have Allison Moe, Tag Silliman, and Juliet Maya Burry.
Tag Silliman.
Excuse me?
Tag Silliman, not Tag Silliman.
Oh, excuse me. If you could sit down and introduce yourself for the record, please.
If we have written...
You can just lay it on the
there by the committee assistant. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Thank you for having us here to talk about this important matter. My name is Allison Moe, and I'm a student board member with Housing Land Advocates, which is a nonprofit organization that advocates for land use policies and practices that ensure an adequate supply of safe, sanitary, and affordable housing for all Oregonians. We at Housing Land Advocates support the concept of inclusionary zoning being made available to jurisdictions in Oregon because it's been proven to be an effective tool in certain communities and certain markets, and it's just not available to jurisdictions here in Oregon at all. In the U.S., should I give a little intro on inclusionary zoning? No need? Okay. So in the U.S., inclusionary housing policies tend to be a local issue. There's only one state that requires it everywhere, only one other statewide ban. And so we really want to see this return to being a local issue. Inclusionary zoning is flexible. It can help jurisdictions provide the needed affordable housing without government subsidy and without raising taxes. And this is going to be it's becoming more and more important as budget cuts, particularly at the federal level, reduce the funding and services that are really important to low-income families and affordable housing providers. Housing Land Advocates has submitted a letter that you guys will see, and it sort of goes over what I just said and outlines some specific ways that inclusionary zoning can benefit Oregon communities. So,
thank you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Co-chairs Hovey and Winston, and a member of the House Committee on Government and Consumer Protection. My name is Taj Suleiman. I'm an organizer with Center for Intercultural Organizing, CIO. It's a multi-racial, multi-cultural, member-run community organization that advocates for immigrants and refugee and people of color rights. You already have my written statement, so I'm going to just cut it down to 2 minutes. Inclusionary zoning must be restored to the affordable housing. If you can lift the ban, would lift many barriers of disparities that our among all race and national of origin. It is a great tool for all immigrants, refugees, and people of color in the state of Oregon to feel part of this fabric of the Oregonian society. There is no cost, and you have already the details on the written testimony. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Juliette Majaburi. I'm here as a representative of the Community Alliance of Tenants. That is the Oregon-only statewide tenants-controlled tenants' rights organization. And I'm also here as a low-income renter that see the inclusionary zone and fair housing is in need. As a member and volunteer with CAD, I work in the hotline and I help a lot of renters supporting and giving them information when they are facing discrimination, unfair fears, or also that they need to move because their house has mold and they are getting sick. And as a CAD, we generally educate people and help them to their rights, to keep their rights and defend their rights. But sometimes and many times when you are in a bad position as a renter, the best situation is move out and leave everything behind. Leave your community, move your kids out of the school, and maybe find creative ways to go to work and things like that. And on the other hand, as a low-income renter, I have faced similar challenges than a lot of people without fair housing face. And is when I moved here from Colombia in 2009, my husband and I, we were sharing a house with another 4 people because we couldn't pay rent. We don't live in that household anymore, but we still share a house because we cannot pay rent by ourselves for a place for ourselves. And yet, our place is really close to my job, so that is convenient for me. We pay around 50% of our income on rent and bills. I hope that for the near future we can find a place for ourselves, and maybe eventually have a house, but with the rent so high, it's impossible, like, really be realistic and save some money for a down payment for a house. I'm not an expert on policy, but I think that inclusionary zone makes a lot of sense for me, especially because I would like to eventually have my own place, as I've said a couple of times. And affordable housing for all Oregonians, it's important, even though there are no money for build out of houses. And I believe that even if you disagree with the policies and how the policies apply, you should agree that it's important and it should be available. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and for keeping it to our time constraints before us. I appreciate your testimony, and we'll keep this conversation going, I'm sure, and having a more dialogue about it. But at this point, I'm going to call up some more testifiers. I'm not seeing anybody jumping up with questions for you this time. Thank you very much. Next up, Heidi Gwynn, maybe?
Yes.
Ari Ripkin? And Reverend Joseph Santos. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. My name is Heidi Ginnan. I'm the Transportation Policy Coordinator for Upstream Public Health. Upstream's mission is to foster and promote better public health in Oregon by advancing policies that create the social and economic environments where all Oregonians can thrive. Upstream supports the overturning of the inclusionary zoning ban because at its core, housing is a public health issue. Where you live has a large impact on your health, and affordable mixed-income housing promotes positive health outcomes. For example, affordable housing options can free up household financial resources for other important needs such as food or access to health care. Children who move from neighborhoods with high concentrations of poverty to neighborhoods with mixed incomes perform better in school, creating a foundation for lifelong health and access to opportunity. Inclusionary zoning also promotes residential stability and promotes higher density development, allowing for greater provision of green space and recreational opportunities with all of their attendant health benefits. Inclusionary zoning policies can bring the workforce closer to jobs, to recreation, to access to health care, while reducing reliance on personal automobiles, increasing opportunities for physical activity, reducing air pollution, and reducing risk of collisions. And lastly, Oregon is making large investments, public investments, in our transportation system, and jurisdictions need to have the land use tools available to make sure that those public investments are meeting Oregon's larger goals, and ensuring that the existing communities are not priced out of those areas, and that transit-dependent riders can still afford to access that new infrastructure that we've invested in as a public. Upstream strongly encourages this committee to overturn the ban and put this tool back in the hands of communities that are striving to create a healthier Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ari Rapkin, and I'm a co-director for the Community Alliance of Tenants. And we're a tenant membership organization statewide with more than 1,600 members. And low-income tenants, predominantly low-wage workers, families with kids, people with disabilities, seniors, people of color, are our primary membership base. And since our inception, the membership has really identified the lack of affordable housing as one of the main barriers to stability, safety, and opportunity. The majority of our membership is paying over 50% of their income for rent, some even more than 70%. And low-income tenants have far fewer options of where they can live and are unable to move of areas of opportunity that can help improve their lives. And that's a problem that we're hearing throughout the state. So an inclusive housing policy provides safe, accessible, affordable housing in communities by allowing local governments to let housing developers set aside a percentage of new units at below market rates or contribute to an affordable housing fund. And in exchange, developers receive benefits that reduce construction costs and encourage businesses. So local governments can tailor their own inclusive housing policies to fit housing needs, zoning codes, and real estate markets of their own particular jurisdiction. Local control of affordable housing strategies supports our belief that problem solving can best occur at the local level, where people have a better chance to have a direct say in the decisions that impact their lives. Unnecessary constraints, such as the statewide preemptive ban, severely limit a local jurisdiction's options to work directly with the people most affected by these problems and to direct their solutions. Hardworking families should have the opportunity to remain in their communities, to stay involved, and to contribute to health and vitality. Often tenants are involuntarily displaced from their communities due to rising property values and rents. And if new developments in an area were to provide more mixed-income housing options, that would not only help stem displacement, but maintain vital community networks and promote equal opportunity for all Oregonians. So by encouraging the creation of affordable housing and new developments, inclusive housing policies can help deconcentrate poverty and reduce crime. So we all benefit from a community where residents have access to opportunity, and with this policy tool, renters with low incomes benefit through lower rents and stable housing so that they can afford to stay in safe communities.
Thank you.
Housing developers benefit by the various incentives involved, and local governments benefit by freeing up housing funds to target lower income groups. So,
if you could conclude, please, Emma. Thank you.
Sure. You know, this affordable housing is key to stable, thriving communities, and this is a critical tool to help create those communities. So we just urge you to support.
Thank you.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Joseph Santos Lyons. I'm here in my capacity as co-director for OPAL Environmental Justice Oregon. I'm here today to support House Bill 3531, repealing ORS 197.309 and the current statewide preemption on inclusionary zoning. I have 20 years of experience doing community organizing around racial and environmental justice in our communities. As a community member and also an ordained minister affiliated with the First Unitarian Church of Portland, I believe that we all have a commitment to providing housing for the needs of the members of our communities. That building diverse, stable neighborhoods and cities depends on our abilities, on the abilities of our local and regional planning bodies to provide for equally diverse, sustainable housing stock. The current preemption in Oregon on inclusionary zoning takes a basic planning tool that jurisdictions use throughout the country to plan for this type of diverse housing stock and places it outside the reach of our cities and regional planning bodies. In 2007, the Journal of the American Planning Association published an article by Kirk McClure promoting the use of inclusionary zoning as one tool that planners should use to effectively deconcentrate poverty, open up new housing stocks to low and moderate income families and renters. Promoting and requiring mixed use, mixed income developments will help our cities and suburban areas throughout the state to experience smart, environmentally friendly growth that provides for the entire community. By deconcentrating poverty, communities are able to effectively raise the standard of living for everyone and can help break the cycle of poverty by providing safe, secure neighborhoods and housing options. Mixed income development attracts businesses. This leads to an increase in local jobs. Mixed income developments promote transit corridors that reduce greenhouse gas emissions and provide more access to all communities. By attracting neighborhood markets and grocery stores, mixed income developments can increase the food security. These are benefits that tend to be conspicuously absent from our low-income neighborhoods across Oregon, and these are part of the reasons why we need to have this inclusionary zoning tool. So I believe that you'd agree with me that we need to have local policy options to improve our neighborhoods. During this session, I encourage you on the committee to examine the benefits of passing House Bill 3531 and give the power back to local control to be able to create the kind of diverse, sustainable, secure housing for all members of our communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Next up, I'd like to have Sean Jillians, John Chandler, who doesn't appear to be here, so don't know if you had anybody else to back you up there, but could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I just got a text from Mr. Chandler as well. He's stuck in a residential energy tax credit hearing right now, and so he can't make it over here. Another issue near and dear to our hearts. But we did discuss this last night. Unfortunately, I think the testimony you've heard today, we agree with all the principles that these advocates are advocating for. As far as affordable housing, we just tend to disagree with the method to get there. And mandatory inclusionary zoning doesn't necessarily advance some of the objectives that we're looking for there. The one thing I just point out, Mr. Chair, because there's been a lot of talk about incentives for developers that they could receive with inclusionary zoning policies, if you look at 197309, which is the prohibition against mandatory inclusionary zoning. Sub 2 says, and I'm going to read it line for line, Mr. Chair, this section does not limit the authority of a city, county, or metropolitan service district to A, adopt or enforce a land use regulation, functional plan provision, or condition of approval creating or implementing an incentive, contract commitment, density bonus, or other voluntary regulation provision or condition designed to increase the supply of moderate or lower housing cost units. Cities have the authority to implement density bonuses, other incentives for inclusionary zoning policies under the current statute. To date, not a single city in Oregon has taken up that opportunity. Some of you know, Mr. Chair, my past life, I lobbied for the city of Henderson in Southern Nevada. We actually did have a program where we did voluntary programs where developers would have a subdivision plan for a certain number of units, and it was zoned for that number of units. When they came in and asked for additional units, then the city would say, okay, in exchange for additional units, you have to set aside this many for affordable housing. It was quite a successful program. It did provide an incentive for the developer to do it, and we ended up with some below market rate units. Unfortunately, when you do it on a mandatory basis, what ends up happening, because not to channel Mr. Chandler, but his members aren't doing very well right now, and when they have to subsidize below market rate units, that increases the cost on the other units, which is where we get concerned when the market rate units are actually increased in cost, because there isn't the massive profit there that perhaps there was during the boom years. I can see Representative Smith likely has some questions with that, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Smith, did you have a question, or were you just...
Well, now that you mention it.
Intently.
And I would like to make this very, very short,
sure,
because I have just
another
bill to come up.
I don't have a bunch of questions. I do. In Nevada, do they have the same or similar prohibition on inclusionary zoning?
They actually not... Nevada is very different in that they're not a home rule state. And so they have to go to the state legislature. Every local government has to go to the legislature to have their charter implemented. So by not having the authority to do mandatory inclusionary zoning, yes, in fact, it's similar. It's prohibited. They would have to, each local entity would have to go to the state legislature and ask for permission to be able to do it.
Cool. Thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. And... for the record, we'll note that Mr. Chandler was in opposition to this bill.
Oh, no, he was in favor.
So with that, I'm going to call up Midge Purcell, Jonathan Oster, and Representative Smith.
I have written testimony. Don't read it.
And if you're turning in written testimony, please don't read it to us. Just summarize it. I am behind schedule, but so if you could make your testimony brief and concise.
I shall, or I shall try. Not one of my long suits, I must say. Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Mitch Purcell, and I'm with the Urban League of Portland. And the Urban League is a nonprofit organization that has historically provided services and advocacy for the African-American community in Portland. We are situated in Northeast Portland, which was the home of the majority African-American community for many years, since 1945, when our organization was founded. But it isn't any longer. The last census indicated that the four majority census tracts, majority African American census tracts, had dwindled to one, and the current census confirms that trend, with African Americans no longer being the majority in any area in North Northeast Portland. I will summarize by saying that redevelopment and urban renewal programs have resulted in gentrification. Our community, like many other communities of color, is growing, but much more dispersed to areas where there are poor transportation links, fewer economic and employment prospects, and greater social isolation and distance from churches, barbershops, and service organizations. The Urban League supports inclusionary zoning as an effective strategy for addressing the crisis of affordable housing. What's happened in Portland has happened in communities across the country, which is why 48 out of 50 states use inclusionary zoning as a tool to stabilize neighborhoods and mitigate against displacement. We feel that inclusionary zoning gives cities the tools that they need to enforce policies to ensure affordable housing stock. The previous speaker mentioned...
And if you could wrap up with a
right,
conclusion.
Okay, voluntary measures. We believe that they have not proven as effective as they could be in most cities. So we urge you to support HB 3531 and repeal the ban on inclusionary zoning.
Thank you. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, co-chairs, committee members. My name is Jonathan Oster. I'm here representing the Coalition for Affordable and Safe Housing, whose members you've graciously given time today to testify on this important bill. I wanted to just fill in a couple of points that haven't been discussed and to respond to the gentleman from the realtor lobby who testified just previously. We used to have, local jurisdictions had the right to impose inclusionary zoning at the local level, and that was taken away in 1999. Without any discussion really of the merits of the policy, of whether this was good for affordable housing, it was taken away solely to protect profits for home builders and developers and realtors. That was a really poor choice for local communities across the state. This is not a Portland metro region issue. This is a statewide issue. We have states, we have cities across the state that are experiencing their own unique issues with regards to an influx of residents, long-time residents being priced out. And what inclusionary zoning does allow? It allows those cities to customize the policy. So we don't have this one-size-fits-all policy that either has to be blanket spread across the state or a blanket prohibition across the state. It gives local jurisdictions the control and the flexibility they need to customize the policy. Now, over 170 jurisdictions in California alone use inclusionary zoning, both a combination of mandatory and incentive-based. And I think what was misleading, if not intentionally, but what is misleading about the gentleman from the realtors lobby reading you Section 2, which lays out the right of jurisdictions to implement an incentive-based policy, is that the incentives are only as good as the carrots. The carrots are only as good as the sticks. If you don't have the sticks, the carrots don't work because there's no incentive on the part of the developers to engage in that kind of conversation. There has been some limited examples in the Portland metro region of a public-private partnership to create some affordable housing, but it's only when the public is sitting on very prime real estate. Now, that's not the case that's going to happen across the state.
If you could conclude, please.
Absolutely. And so the way that an inclusionary zoning policy can work in a local jurisdiction is it allows the local jurisdiction to offer incentives in exchange for the requirement to set aside units so that the developers do not lose their profit margins. It's being used all across the state. We're out of step. We're one of two states, the other being Texas, that have this prohibition, and it's time to repeal the prohibition and restore the rights to local jurisdictions. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Smith, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Jefferson Smith, representing District 47 in the Oregon House. The want to thank the great coalition that is coming together on this and came to testify. I want to thank the committee for hearing the bill. To be clear, this is to give tools and controlled localities where the decisions belong. This is not a statewide requirement for inclusionary zoning. It is eliminating a prohibition from local control. I think putting decision-making where it belongs has three at least reasons beyond just the principle of local control. One is it would allow for affordable housing improvements without being limited to tools like tax credits or statewide subsidies that we can't afford. I, too, would support any number of those tools. I'd be interested in the proposal for how we're going to get those in the budget. I don't see it happening. The two others, and what I'll essentially close with, is about families and safety. This is not only not just an urban issue. It's not only about poor families looking for affordable housing. What we know now is that if you have neighborhoods that are under 5% in working professionals, people who get dressed to go to work, okay, versus neighborhoods that are more than 5% working professionals, people who get dressed to go to work, you see huge differences in teen pregnancy and juvenile crime. Between 5% and 40%, very little difference in teen pregnancy and juvenile crime. If you have relatively integrated neighborhoods with economic diversity, etc., they police themselves, they have good examples, they build good communities. As soon as you hit below that tipping point, as soon as you get below 5%, you see big spikes in teen pregnancy, big spikes in juvenile crime. This is one of the most cost-effective things we can do to keep our neighborhoods safer and our families more together. I hope this conversation will truly be ongoing.
Thank you. I appreciate your concise testimony. It is a big issue with some great goals, I think, and a conversation that needs to continue. So with that, I appreciate everyone's testimony, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3531 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3477. And Representative Conger, I apologize for cutting you a little bit short on the bill. However, there's not many people signed up to testify on yours, but I want to give you an opportunity to present. Certainly, Carla K. Edwards, and we'll let those two come up, and then we'll do the other two, because I think they're in opposition. So it appears to me that we got about three or four minutes or so apiece. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, whoever wants to go first.
Well, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity, co-chairs Wisnett and Hovley. My name is Carla K. Edwards. I'm with Cascade Policy Institute, and we're here today in support of House Bill 3477. We think the opportunity to send out contracts for services to our state parks is something that makes a lot of sense and has an opportunity not only to save expenses but to increase revenues. This isn't something new. In fact, many of our federal parks do this very same process. Crater Lake Lodge is, in fact, managed by Xterra Parks and Lodge, which also runs Grand Canyon and multiple other national parks and the commercial services of which they provide. In addition, we have one that most people don't realize that we have that is a private owner that actually has a contract service with the U.S. Department of Forestry, and that would be Timberline Lodge. It is very infamous and very much a destination for many people that visit the state of Oregon. Built in 1936, this lodge on Mount Hood had very tumultuous history in the first 20 years of this lodge. It went bankrupt and belly up within four times within a 20-year period. It wasn't until the family of the Constames were actually able to look at this property and say, negotiate with the Department of Forestry, that in fact they felt like there was an opportunity for them. And in 1955, they took over this dilapidated lodge, which now is an icon in the crown of Oregon's tourist destinations. It's their theory in the fact that they felt like they had to manage it like they owned it that has allowed them to be very successful and to create a very successful partnership with the Department of Forestry. They believe it was the weight of the federal government themselves that was unable to actually look and to look as an entrepreneur what the opportunities could be. And because this private family came in and looked at it in an entrepreneurial eye, that they were able to discover different ways of which the Forest Service had never really conceptually thought about how that park could be ran. It now maintains weddings, summer parks, all kinds of things besides just the winter recreation that it has. And it is a crown again in our tour, in our jewel. We believe that this has an opportunity, this bill offers an opportunity to do the same with our state parks, to really allow an entrepreneurial spirit look into our parks and see not only to manage as we know them, but to allow an outside eye to say, what are the other opportunities to create revenues and economy and to stimulate potential more tourist spots within our state parks. For one example, we have a lot of state parks on the state, on our coastal areas, and most of them generally are not managed day to day, and they're closed from dawn. They open from dawn to dusk. But
and
in
if
fact,
if you could conclude, otherwise, Representative Conger won't have any time.
Yeah, in fact, the opportunities are that there could be people that do picnics and those type of things, and allow those parks to stay beyond dusk, or because most people want to see the sunset on the ocean. Again, this is an important concept because it allows an entrepreneurial spirit to really invest in the other opportunities that are out there. It allows both a revenue decrease and a potential increase of what is offered to different tourism aspects.
Thank you.
Representative Jason Conger from House District 54, co-chairs and member of the committee. Thank you all for hanging in there till the end. I really appreciate it. And I'm going to limit my comments to very quickly talk about what the potential is for these kinds of concessions. I think we all understand that parks and national forest camp areas and things like that have been handed over to private management in a variety of ways, and that would include things like concessions for retail operations, for food operations, for limited parts of the service offering to people who want to take advantage of those facilities. And it also could include, in many cases, the whole park, management of the whole park. What this offers to us, I think, is a variety of potential advantages, and really we won't know what the true potential is until we give it a shot. So the idea of the bill is to try a pilot program in the state of Oregon to see how well we can make this work. The concept is that ideally we could take parks that are currently a burden on our general fund and turn them into revenue generators by injecting new management, new ideas, new welcome, Representative Clem. Thank you for joining us. Scott Conger. I'm Representative Clem from where? What?
Central East Salem.
Sorry, I got confused there. So the idea is that maybe there are ways that we could be not only saving money but generating money to support other parks. Conceptually, I think a lot of this would be left to the Park Service itself, the state parks, to design contracts where vendors could come in, manage the parks, and would be, again, ideally giving us a percentage of whatever fee revenue that they obtain. These would not be subsidized contracts. These would be contracts where the state is actually getting paid from the revenue generated by the park operator. Other advantages include taking parks off the budget, off the roller coaster of the budget, could provide more stable funding. It's possible if revenues are being generated in the parks that instead of having the state be required to cough up money for capital improvements, a private vendor could be persuaded to do so, again with a properly structured contract. And ultimately, with a thoughtful relationship between the state and the vendor, there's no reason that other goals of the public agency couldn't be met, like environmental goals and educational goals and other things. Those can all be structured into the contractual relationship with the vendor. So with that, I'll conclude by saying 70 parks are being closed. 70 parks are being closed in the state of California. May I suggest that we would do well to look south of the border for examples of how not to run our state?
Thank you. And if you want to stay in that vicinity, I'm going to bring up the other two, let them testify, then we'll potentially have some time for questions. If you're comfortable staying down on that side of the...
I don't know. I'm getting nervous.
Next up, I want to bring up John Potter and Amelia Porterfield. Good morning, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Sure. My name's John Potter. I'm with the Parks and Recreation Department. I serve as the operations manager for the state parks. And I understood there was interest in looking at private contracting in state parks, and so I want to come and give you some information and answer any questions that you might have. Currently, the department uses private contracting in the form of concessions and also contracting out on direct services ranging from janitorial to construction to maintenance, lawn mowing, that sort of thing, in a variety of parks throughout the system. We currently have 9 active concessions throughout the park system, and they include operating marinas, stores, hotels, and also food service. Several parks are successfully operated almost entirely by private contractors, including French Glen Hotel and Wolf Creek Inn. Not all of our experiences with concessions have gone so smoothly as those two, and you know, I wanted to just share with you some of the challenges with private contracting, just so that you can consider that. Generally, there are things like maintaining a standard of service that the public expects, having concessionaires accept and enforce park rules. That's been a challenge in places. Adequately maintaining facilities and addressing citizen complaints in a timely and acceptable manner. We will occasionally get complaints in concession parks, and there's always discussions about how best to address those, and the state having a limited, kind of a distant relationship through a contractor, sometimes the immediacy of a response is not there. And really, the biggest challenge is if things kind of go south and aren't working real well, our main recourse is legal, and that can be very expensive, and you know, not something that the state wants to get into. An example that I have is an attempt at a full park concession that we did at Lake Oahe State Park in the early 2000s. In that situation, the department tried to concession out both campgrounds there, the restroom cleaning, the day use oversight, and the marina operation. And this concession failed because the concessionaire had really high expectations going in, and the traffic just did not materialize the way that they had expected. They ended up with some borrowing and some bank loans to make it work, and they had to reduce service levels, and they didn't meet the terms of the contract. Instead of getting into a big legal mess, we ended up settling and at considerable cost buying out the contract, going back to public maintenance of the facility. So finding quality concessionaires has been a challenge that we've struggled with, and we found some great ones, but many times people are drawn to recreation because they love it and they think it's going to be a great business, but if they're not really good business people, they you know, who can manage staff and really keep costs down, it's not a great business for them. We found that many of the state campgrounds are just too small to attract the level of visitation like Timberline or some of the federal parks to really be able to maintain the staff and maintain the facilities that make it a worthwhile, a profitable enterprise. So our focus has been on providing people a quality experience, balancing the experience that we're providing with sort of whether how many people to pack in there, because you could really increase the number of sites and the number of activity, but that detracts from the quality of the park experience. At least that's what we hear from the customers. But that said, the department really supports the idea of private contracting and uses it in the right situations. And we're currently doing a system-wide business analysis to look at this further, to see if private concessions could be further expanded in other ways, and in ways to kind of avoid some of the past problems that we've experienced.
And if you could kind of make a conclusion here.
And so that's really what I wanted to tell you, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right, thank you. And if you could identify yourself for the record and
certainly
give us some testimony.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Amelia Porterfield with SEIU Local 503. We represent over 20,000 state workers, including those at the State Parks and Recreation Department. We're here with some significant concerns about this bill, which seems to do two main things. First, it does the pilot project that we've been discussing, but it also would exempt the State Parks and Recreation Department from the fair and accountable contracting laws that were passed a couple years ago. So to the pilot project itself, we've seen, we represent dozens of agencies around the state. Other agencies have also been required to conduct pilot projects on contracting out certain services, maintenance, operations, those kinds of things. We often see it doesn't really pencil out. And one very recent example, ODOT's been, as part of House Bill 2001, I believe, last session, has been doing a pilot project on maintenance of a stretch of state highway. They're finding that the contractor is costing about 80% over what it would cost to do in-house, and also there's some mistakes made that the in-house staff are having to correct, as well as the agency is still leasing its own equipment to the contractor. So it's not actually a cost-effective thing to do there. We'd be concerned about another agency following suit with a similar pilot project in these tough financial times, adding additional costs to what it does to currently provide those services. We're also concerned about the items that this pilot project would report back on, and we find there are some things missing there. There's no requirement that the report include internal costs to manage the contracting relationships. We see in other agencies that can be quite expensive, and then you have double overhead that the state pays for. Also, how much the contractors would use the state's infrastructure, and if that has a cost associated. And then the as far as the pilot project allowing contractors to levy fees to cover their costs, it's something that we saw in the parks budget, which came before the Ways and Means Subcommittee yesterday. There had been a proposal in the governor's budget to allow fee increases to keep up with inflation to help cover the costs of parks. That doesn't appear to be going forward in the budget, but on the other hand, allowing contractors to charge whatever fees they deem fit to cover their costs seems concerning and inconsistent policy there. We don't know what the impact would be to park users, and that doesn't seem to be a part of the reporting back also, or either. And then just quickly to the contracting provisions that have been in statute the last couple years. Current law requires agencies and local governments also to go through a basic cost analysis of whether it is, in fact, more efficient to contract or to do services in-house. And this bill seems to exempt this department from not only the pilot project in doing that analysis, but in an ongoing way. And that seems to be, it's troubling to us in tough economic times to reduce scrutiny on whether it does make sense to contract out financially. And I've included a chart that just is the basic process that agencies go through in determining whether to contract out or do work in-house. And so because we're in a tough financial times and for all those other reasons, we don't want to reduce scrutiny on those items. And with all due respect to all of the sponsors of the bill, looking at creative solutions in a tough financial time, we appreciate that, but we don't think this is the right way to go.
I have a question.
Thank you. So we have a little bit of time for some questions. Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Potter, I would appreciate if you would provide the committee administrators some written documentation of what you've done, what you're trying to do, and some problems you've had and successes you've had, please.
Yes, sir, Co-Chair. We'll do that.
Other questions for this panel? I certainly appreciate Representative Conger bringing this forward. I think it is an interesting proposal about whether or not this is something that we can maintain good services and provide a different type of experience with our state parks. but at the same time recognizing that if our state parks were able to charge the same that the contracts charge, what is that trade-off? What is the best way to accomplish that? And I think it's a conversation we'll probably continue to have. So I'll appreciate further looking into this. Representative Conger, any thoughts or...
No, thanks for the time. Thanks for the testimony, and look forward to finding some ways to provide better services to people who want to access our parks and find ways to keep our parks open instead of closing them. And hope we can take this up next session.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Seeing no other questions, comments, I appreciate your attentiveness today as we went through this. On Thursday, we'll be back looking at public hearings and work sessions on the bills remaining in the committee that are posted. So we have a pretty full agenda on Thursday and probably again on Tuesday. So I appreciate people being here ready to vote on some of those legislative proposals. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3477 and adjourn the committee, the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection.
Is Thursday our last meeting?
No.